Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1999, during the last tech boom, about one-third of San Francisco households put more than half of their pay toward rent or mortgage. Well, here we are 16 years later, and close to half of San Francisco residents are spending more than half of their gross income on a rent or a mortgage. Nationwide, it's about 22%. Far too many San Francisco residents and people throughout the Bay Area are struggling to make ends meet in the country's most expensive region. One in four people in San Francisco and Marin struggle to put enough food on the table. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how the soaring cost of living and the housing crisis are affecting the Bay Area's working poor. How are janitors, school teachers, nurses, receptionists, and people with very limited income making it? It's hard enough for those in the middle to make ends meet. What about people who are struggling? What about people who live on Social Security checks, which average between $800 and $1,200 a month? San Francisco Public Press's forthcoming issue takes an in-depth look into what it costs to live in San Francisco and what needs to be done to make the city more affordable for middle and low-income residents. Angela Woodall is a freelance journalist based in Berkeley. Her special report on the high cost of living in San Francisco is published in the next edition of San Francisco Public Press. It hits newsstands tomorrow, and it'll be online on Wednesday. And Angela joins me here in studio. Hi, Angela. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you, and thank you for your reporting. We're also joined by Carl Kramer. Carl is co-campaign director of San Francisco's Living Wage Coalition, a grassroots movement of low-wage workers and their allies fighting for economic justice. Hi, Carl. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Angela, I want to start off with you. You know, we decided to do this show because even those of us who make a decent living are struggling to make ends meet. We're hoping to keep our apartments, especially if they're rent controlled. And I find that because the conversation is about how are we going to stay here, the conversation about those who are struggling, it doesn't get as much attention as I think it deserves. So San Francisco Public Press is coming out with this massive report about the cost of living, and you worked on that report. This is a big issue. How did you decide where to focus?
Well, actually, what we saw those dynamics that you're talking about, that it's having a job in San Francisco is no longer sufficient to live here. And more people are being pushed out. I live in Oakland, and I see the dynamics there. So the San Francisco Public Press decided that we wanted to look at what was happening to people. So we heard the headlines, we read the headlines, but what does it really feel like to be in that situation where you're so close to a major crisis, and more people are? So we decided to sort of pick apart, you know, one big issue, which is the cost of living. So what does it really look like, and why is the cost, like, what does that mean, the cost of living? So we looked at a number of indicators, and for me, it was really about accountability. So what kind of planning went into the cultivation of the tech sector in San Francisco? But then we decided we wanted to pick apart several major things within the cost of living. So housing, for example, we knew that was a big driver, but we didn't want to only focus on that. So we looked at healthcare, the cost of healthcare. We looked at transportation. We looked at connectivity, so the internet, just things like that. The cost of food, that was a really big driver as well. And we wanted to really see how that was affecting San Franciscans.
And so you have lived in the Bay Area your entire life. You've seen major, major changes. What really stood out for you the most doing your reporting?
I think what stood out the most for me in San Francisco particularly was just the fact that things were so distorted. The cost of living is so distorted in San Francisco that people who would be considered poor anywhere else are considered seriously poor in San Francisco. If you're middle class in San Francisco, you are hovering right around the poverty line. So you're so close to a major crisis here. And the fact is that San Francisco is bifurcated in its administration. So in some cases, you have the city departments like public health understand that this is the case. They understand that San Francisco is an aberration and that it's a very expensive place to live, and that you can't use federal poverty guidelines, for example. You can't use the regular consumer price index. You have to really think about San Francisco as an entity in and of itself. And some organizations have come up with alternative measures. For example, the Public Policy Institute of California has a self-sufficiency index that is considered, if not implemented, in San Francisco's
the poverty level?
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking of the healthcare, for example. So I'm thinking of the they take that into, so some parts of San Francisco's administration take that into account, some don't. And I would say the mayor's office doesn't take it into account at all. And that really stood out to me was just, you know, in that case, for example, with childcare subsidies, that's not accounted for. The expense that's going up is not accounted for entirely in San Francisco. So the middle class is really sort of at the poverty line, and that stood out the most for me.
So you spoke with Sarah Bond with the Public Policy Institute of California, and she said that if the federal poverty level accurately reflected the cost of living and the full set of resources received from government programs, about 24% of San Francisco residents, 200,000, would be considered poor or nearly poor.
And that's right. And that's compared to the percentage that San Francisco uses. If you're going by the federal poverty level that the state, the city, and the federal government uses, it would be only 14% in San Francisco and 14.3% in the United States. So that's a big difference.
That is a big difference. Angela Woodall is a freelance journalist, and she worked on a special report about the high cost of living in San Francisco for the San Francisco Public Press. It'll be on newsstands tomorrow and then online on Wednesday. Carl Kramer is co-campaign director of San Francisco's Living Wage Coalition. And Carl, service workers, those jobs are actually increasing. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Stats projected that almost 10 million new jobs created between now and 2024 will pay about $15 or less with no benefits. So talk a little bit about how people making minimum wage or even $15 an hour are being affected by this economic boom.
Well, one of the groups of workers we're working with, assisting them in the struggle with an employer, are janitors. In particular, in San Francisco, there's kind of a dual universes of between companies that have a union contract and pay pretty good wages and provide benefits, and then this underworld of companies that are in large part targeting immigrant workers, enforcing them to often in situations of being paid less than the minimum wage, no overtime pay, no meal breaks. And one of the companies we've been battling is Preferred Building Services, which has contracts at places like One Rincon, Millennium Tower, places where the condominiums start at $2 million. We have a situation between the way that Supervisor David Campos described it. We have the tale of two cities. We have those that are doing incredibly well, and then we have, according to a study by Stanford University that looked at poverty level is based on what the cost of living is in different parts of California, we have 23% of the population in San Francisco living in poverty. And just to be clear, what a living wage is right now in San Francisco, California Budget Project has been tracking the self-sufficiency standards that show that in San Francisco it takes about $39 an hour to just lift out of poverty and be self-sufficient.
$39 an hour?
$39 an hour.
And what are the janitors making, the janitors you talked about earlier at these high-rise buildings?
Well, they were making at the city minimum wage. Sometimes they were paid less than the minimum wage. And then the as you know, the voters in San Francisco increased the city minimum wage in the last elections to now currently it's $12.25 per hour, and going up to $13 an hour in the middle of next year. But nobody is claiming that that's something that people can survive on.
Well, and so what are you hearing, Carl, from people who are making $12.25 an hour in San Francisco, and so many of these people are breadwinners in their families?
Yeah, the people that we're working with, and they're largely women who are doing cleaning of commercial offices and in condominium the common areas of luxury condominium buildings. They have up to four children. Most of them have at least a couple children. And
are they being forced to leave the Bay Area?
A couple are living up in Richmond, in the East Bay, but largely they're in San Francisco. With the current housing crisis, we have families that are doubling up or tripling up in apartments. Some of the workers that we've talked with that describe a situation where they don't really rent rooms, you rent shifts in a bed. So someone who's working the night shift will come in and sleep during the day, and then somebody who's working a day shift will come and sleep in the same bed at night.
Can you elaborate on that, Carl? What do you mean rent beds? So they don't actually have their own room or home?
They rent a shift in a bed that they have to share the bed with their roommate.
I see what you're
where
saying.
Where they have, a flat where they have three bedrooms. The common area of the living, what would be a living room, also becomes a bedroom, and oftentimes that's subdivided where there's a rope that's hanging across it, and sheets hung down as a curtain, and someone comes and sleeps in the bed, and then one of the housemates after that person gets up and leaves for work. When the housemates comes in and sleeps in the same bed.
So you could have multiple people in one apartment and they're staying in the same room in the same bed, but they have to make sure they sleep at different times.
Exactly. And we was brought into one household that the rooms were divided up with ropes and sheets. It was hard to even count how many different little kind of cubicle areas there were, where there were just mattresses down on the floor.
How common is this in San Francisco, Carl?
Well, it's a large part because the mayor's economic development policies, which have been because of the influence of venture capitalists and his administration, and particularly those that are venture capitalists in the high-tech and biotech industries. The mayor's adopted economic development model of luring in high-tech companies from outside of the city with tax breaks and subsidies, and these companies are bringing a workforce from outside of the city. And because there's so much investment capital, and in our view, this is a replay of the balloon economy of the dot-com boom of the late 90s, they can afford to pay their workers pretty well. In fact, upwards of $150,000 a year. And then the real estate speculators have come in like sharks to take over buildings, evict tenants, to rent apartments to these high-tech workers at a median rent of $3,500 a month for a one-bedroom apartment. So this is completely unsustainable, but as long as there's this kind of bubble that's been created by all this investment capital, we have this very dysfunctional economy that is creating harm for everybody else in the city. And we've seen with the in past history where the economic development policies are focused on one particular kind of industry, one to the detriment of everybody else. The mayor is has largely abandoned job training programs in the city, and particularly in welfare to work programs. There's a group of workers that we're working with, the mothers who are in welfare to work programs, where they're working for a public assistance check, and these are African American Latino mothers who are whose families have long histories in the city, where their grandparents came in to Bayview Hunters Point to work in the shipyards during World War II and built up that southeast area of the city. And now at third generation, they are not getting any kind of job training, access to employment opportunities, and they're being forced out of the city. And we see, once they are forced out of San Francisco and to, environs in the, out in Pittsburgh or Antioch, they aren't going to be coming back to the city. And we have lost a large part of a generation of people who, grew up in this city and contributed a large part to the diversity of our city.
Right. That is Carl Kramer. He's co-campaign director of San Francisco's Living Wage Coalition, a grassroots movement of low-wage workers and their allies fighting for economic justice. We're also joined by Angela Woodall, a freelance journalist who worked on a special report for San Francisco Public Press called Cost of Living. And it comes out tomorrow on newsstands. It'll be online on Wednesday. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What changes are you seeing in your area? And if you were already struggling before the tech boom, what has it been like for you? What's it like for you today with the cost of housing soaring across the Bay Area? Not only that, but just the cost of living. And what about city government? How is your city government tackling these issues? What should happen? What changes would you like to see? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you're making minimum wage or you're on a fixed income, say Social Security, how are you coping with the soaring cost of living in the Bay Area? As Angela has reported, the Social Security Administration just announced that for the next year, it's not going to make a cost of living adjustment. 65 million Americans currently receive Social Security checks. And in San Francisco, a lot of them sleep on the streets. And in some cases, they sleep on pews during the day. St. Boniface Church, in relationship with the Gubbio Project, allows people to sleep on church pews during the day. And I was there a couple weeks ago and met 65-year-olds who get a Social Security check, but they can't afford rent. So we'd love to hear your stories. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Angela, people on fixed incomes are also sometimes missing from these conversations. A lot of people get a Social Security check, $800 to $1,200 on average. How are they surviving?
Well, that's a good question. I think the administration might be in the position to answer that question. But from my reporting, what I saw is that they are largely silent in this conversation, and they they are receiving benefits, they are receiving services. And San Francisco does have a pretty robust safety net. But like you said, with the Consumer Price Index, for example, we don't really think of that often, but it drives a lot of the policy. It drives how much we spend on things. And San Francisco just hasn't kept up with that. So, for example, housing, food, and healthcare are absorbing an increasing amount of our income. So if you are on Social Security, you've got a fixed income. It's going to keep increasing. It's going to keep absorbing your income until you have very little left, until you are marginalized out of the conversation and out of the context. And I was thinking about the janitors, for example. So the Native American Health Center, these effects are really sort of across the board. The Native American Health Center in San Francisco, they are thinking about moving out of the city, not because of rising rents, but because their workers can't afford to live in San Francisco. And then if they already have an office in Oakland, and they think they're thinking of going down to the peninsula. But the thing is their workers are now having to drive further. So they have to afford the gas and the insurance and the wear and tear, the traffic, and so forth. So it becomes really a terrible cycle of just trying to get by. And poor people pay more for the services and the goods that they get. And they pay sometimes in time, and sometimes it's just the amount of money that they can afford. So it's a really, really difficult thing. And I don't know if we always completely understand how difficult it is to get by when you are not making $40 an hour.
Right. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, everybody. This is a great program. Thank you once again, Rose.
Thank you.
So I have two points that I want to raise, and the primary one is really affordable housing, as defined by not our elected officials. Our supervisors and our mayor currently seem to owe a great deal to the real estate developers and the realtors and the tech companies. And more people are being displaced. Working class people, self-employed people, artists don't have places to live in this city. And so I truly believe that a remedy is for neighbors and residents and people, and I know we're all busy working, but to get together and to define what affordable housing really is for all the levels of people who aren't making six figures a year, and push back against City Hall. Because if you think about it economically, more people are being displaced. They don't have roofs over their heads. They're having to move very far afield, and they're spending 2, 3, 5 hours commuting. Those are hours lost. That's economics.
Right.
That all that money could go to our economy, and we would all thrive. And it really all does come down to affordable housing. And I've been doing some work on this, organizing neighbors in my community, trying to get people to push back. And so many people are apathetic. They just say, oh, there's nothing we can do. They're just controlling it all. And I really believe it's still a democracy, and we've got to compel these elected officials to listen to us and to really.
Well, thank you for calling. We have to take a quick break. Sorry to cut you off, but you make a good point, because in San Francisco, Supervisor Jane Kim has been fighting for affordable housing. And so we're now hearing that all of these new developments, like Mission Rock, for example, an historic 40% affordable housing. But what does that mean exactly? And then also, what about people who are on fixed income? It's almost impossible to find affordable housing if you live on less than $1,000 a month. So we'll talk about that right after the break. Today, on Your Call, we are talking about how poor and poor working communities are struggling to survive in the Bay Area. And income inequality now exceeds national levels. Rent in San Francisco has surpassed Manhattan. Tech companies are starting to move to Oakland, so rents there are soaring. People making good money are struggling to survive. What about poor and low-income communities? And we would love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on these issues? If you fall into these categories, how are you making it? What changes would you like to see? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Many ways to take part in today's conversation on Your Call, on the phone or by sending an email. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. The toll-free call-in number, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. On today's program, the continuing conversation over President Zuma's decision-making and business confidence in South Africa. The country has now had three finance ministers in under a week. Should President Zuma be congratulated for responding to popular anger and moving quickly to ditch his own man, or criticized for being reckless in his oversight of the economy? That's World Have Your Say from the BBC, coming up in 30 minutes.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the Paris Climate Summit. In a landmark deal for the very first time, 195 countries have agreed to prevent global temperatures from rising above 2 degrees Celsius. The pact has been hailed as a victory for the planet, but a lot of critics say the deal doesn't go far enough. So we'll find out what went on behind the scenes and what should be done to truly tackle climate change. That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about how poor and low-income communities are managing to survive in the Bay Area. One in four Bay Area families are living in poverty. Income inequality in the Bay Area exceeds national levels. You know that rents are soaring. So if you fall into these categories, how are you making ends meet? What changes are you seeing in your area? How is your government responding, and how do you think it should? Today we're joined by Carl Kramer, campaign co-director of San Francisco's Living Wage Coalition. Angela Woodall is a journalist who worked on a special report for San Francisco Public Press, Cost of Living in San Francisco. It hits newsstands tomorrow. It'll be online on Wednesday. And Angela, we just had a caller about affordable housing. Lisa wanted to talk about affordable housing. And in San Francisco Public Press's new report, there's a map of gentrification in the Bay Area. And it found that between 2000 and 2013, the region lost 50% of the units defined as affordable for low-income households. At the same time, low-income households region-wide increased by 10%. And so what about that? That word affordable is just being thrown out on a regular basis without any real discussion about what that means.
That's right. Well, I think it goes back to the definitions that are used in general by the people who are doing the making the decisions in the cities and states and the federal government. But it reminds me, though, that in San Francisco, that last year was a record amount of transfer taxes, and that's the money from property taxes. So San Francisco had a record amount of money to spend on services and goods for its people. That's a question of policy and decision making. So is the Measure A bond, which offsets, essentially transfers the cost of developing affordable housing back to taxpayers, is that a good decision, or could we be tapping into some of that, the money that's coming in from property taxes? So I think it's that kind of decision making that's really important and drives that issue. And you know, for example, one of the things that we highlighted in the report were things that the city does and what the city could do. One of that came around taxing secondary housing property that are used as vacation rentals. And that gets back to Airbnb and Vrbo and so forth. So the city could, for example, tax secondary vacation units, or it could incentivize people to rent them out. And I want to just say that my students at San Francisco State University, the journalism students, they did a special, their final project, they looked at this whole issue around what does it take to live in San Francisco if you're 20 to 30 years old? And it was a very scary prospect for them. So if these two of my students lived in an apartment with 10 people total. So two of these girls were with eight other roommates. So they're really making do, these students. And what they were looking at is to say, well, what about all those units that are being used for Airbnb and Vrbo? Would those be places that we would be able to rent? Because we cannot afford to live in San Francisco. We're students, and they are working, and they're making minimum wage, which will not be $15 until 2018, it will be $15, and $15 will not be worth what it is now in 2018. So it's really, it's very difficult. And affordable, you know, what is affordable about that?
Right. Well, we've got a number of calls on the line, so let's go back to calls. Let's go next to Paul Ash, who's the executive director of the Marin San Francisco Food Bank. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
Paul, we found a piece in the SF Weekly. One in four people in San Francisco and Marin struggle to put enough food on the table. This is according to Goldie Pica. She said, you would think that is such a huge number. If 25% of people were hungry, you would see that. But it doesn't look the way you think it does. It's janitors, it's nurses, school teachers, it's elderly people on very limited fixed income, people with disabilities. And 80% of these people actually have roofs over their head.
Well, that's true. Hunger is surprising. You know, we see it every day. Sometimes people helping us in a store, sometimes people providing a service, people we see on the street every day. It's one in four San Franciscans, so it's no small number. And while they're invisible, they're everywhere.
And Paul, we've had you on many times over the years. I mean, people were struggling to make ends meet before the tech boom. So what changes have you seen in the last 2 years?
Well, we hear a lot of participants talk about fear of housing. Not everyone has faced a renewal of their lease or had to leave, but now they have the threat of that. So that's an issue for people. The elderly having to stretch their dollars further when they're in an economy that's very expensive. We don't seem to be able to have an economic situation where everyone thrives. We're doing better than we did at the height of the recession, but we still haven't gotten the number of people that we're providing food for down below where we were at the beginning of the recession.
And Paul, what do you think about how government is or is not responding to this crisis? And would you call it a crisis?
Well, if I was hungry, I would certainly believe it's a crisis. So I think we should all call it a crisis when one in four people don't know where their next meal is coming from. Government has a great program for this. It's the old food stamp program called CalFresh here in California. The problem is, unlike many other states, we don't do a great job of getting people signed up. We have literally hundreds of thousands of Californians who could be getting SNAP or CalFresh benefits, but they're not signed up. So we have a great program. We're not doing a very good job administering it.
And Paul, finally, in the SF Weekly piece, Goldie Pica, who works with SF Marin Food Bank, said that they love the food drives, but if you donate, say, a can of pasta sauce that's worth $2.50, it would go much further if you actually donate the cash because you have great buying power. And we're now, I've seen food bank collection drives all over San Francisco, so I think it's important to let people know about this.
Well, we never want to encourage people from putting food in a food barrel because, you know, emotionally, it's sometimes nice just to be able to know that you're kind of making a connection by putting that box of pasta or cereal in the box. But technically speaking, you know, the dollars that we raise, we can turn that into more money because we sometimes buy truckloads of rice or beans.
Right.
We have arrangements with growers where we can buy fresh produce for 4, 5, 8, and 10 cents on the dollar. So we stretch the dollar a long way. So we don't want to discourage the food drive donations, but we do want to encourage monetary donations.
Right, and the money goes much further. So I'm glad we're putting that out there right before the holiday. Paul, thank you for calling in.
Thank you, Rose.
All right, that is Paul Ash. He's executive director of the Marin San Francisco Food Bank. And let's go next to Jerry in Berkeley. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that it's not just poor and poor working people. I worked as a New York City teacher for 31 years, and between my Social Security and my pension, I cannot pay one of those $3,500 rents. And the second comment is the idea of some sort of subsidized low-income housing seems to be attacking the problem the reverse way. If there was a realistic wage level for
hang up. Oh, did we lose Jerry?
Hmm?
Oh, go ahead, Jerry.
If you'd like to make a call, please.
Sorry, go ahead, Jerry. Oh, we lost Jerry. Okay. Carl, what about that? I mean, can you talk a little bit about the older workers that are struggling to make ends meet? Because not only are their wages low, but they don't have benefits. So what happens when you turn 65 or 70 and, well, your body can't take the work anymore and it's time to retire and stop working? What happens to them?
Well, people aren't retiring when they were planning to. They're extending their working lives because it isn't possible to be able to survive on Social Security. I think we've all, you know, been seeing seniors working in the McDonald's, Burger King's, and Wendy's. It's an ongoing struggle to survive. There is no that idea of the traditional retirement where people go off fishing. That's not happening.
Are you also finding that people that you work with, making low wages or minimum wage, are they going on public assistance? The Washington Post had a piece a couple months ago about how the low wages paid by these multinationals like McDonald's and Walmart are costing taxpayers $153 billion a year because so many people, even though they're working, they have to go on food stamps, for example.
Well, that is one of the subsidies that's being doled out to corporations. I mean, you know, there'd be many of these right-wing politicians have always stigmatized public assistance as, you know, that people who need safety net programs and are on welfare. The fact is that these are this is corporate welfare. These corporations that aren't paying workers wages that they can survive on and support their families, they have to get some form of public assistance to be able to keep bread on the table and roof over the heads of their children. You know, it's a and in fact, these corporations like Walmart actively encourage their employees to go out and apply for food stamps and housing assistance. That they make it clear, you know, we're not going to be paying you a wage that you can pay for these things. And oftentimes these are also the same corporations that are fighting against any kind of paying any kind of taxes and to support the public treasury.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Jerry. Let's go next to Anonymous in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, one thing I didn't hear brought up was I'm on disability, and I live in an SRO in the Tenderloin area, and a lot of these properties here are run and not cared for. In fact, the property I'm living at is currently involved in litigation with the city and county for substandard housing conditions. I am also involved in litigation as an attempt to protect myself and secure my housing, and also, if necessary, I guess, hopefully win a lawsuit where I'll be able to maybe move away from San Francisco because I cannot afford to live here and eat. But the housing here is, majority of this in the Tenderloin, is substandard housing being run into the ground.
Right. Well, thank you for calling. This has been getting some media attention in the last year. A piece in the Weekly finds that the number of families living in SROs, these are single rooms, and sometimes there's a hot pot in the room, but that's about it. There's not much in there at all. You have to share a bathroom down the hall. And the number of families living in these has doubled over the past decade. And in many cases, the conditions inside these SROs are making people living in them sick. Angela, you're shaking your head.
Well, so I have to. I'm probably one of the few reporters I know who grew up in an SRO at one point. So when we lived in San Francisco, I was about like 9, 10 years old. So about the time I was 8 to 10, we lived in an SRO. So where Fior d'Italia was above that is now a retirement home, and then on Broadway above the Big Al's I think it used to be a strip joint as well, but now it's an arcade. So we lived in these SROs. I know what it's like to live in them, and they were probably better maintained at the time than they are now. There at least is some accountability with the SROs and the maintenance that you can turn to some authorities. I really hope that the caller, Anonymous, will be able to find a place that's decent to live. The other end of that is the SROs that are being turned into apartments. So in my story, I talked to a man who, I think he was about 25. He works as a receptionist in a mental health clinic for people who had substance abuse problems. He works actually two or three jobs. I think he took his third job to afford a room in a former SRO. So it's no different. It's just been upgraded a little bit, paint and some nicer flooring. They bill themselves as places for students to stay temporarily. But what they really are glorified SROs. And he pays for to share a room. Half of his salary goes to sharing this room.
How much is it to share a room, or how much is an SRO room right now?
Well, and I'm trying to remember exactly how much the total. So I think it was $1,500 for him, and then another $1,500 for his roommate, if I'm not mistaken. And so I have to look again at the story, but it was quite expensive. So in other words, like half of his income every month is spent on his housing. And there, he has no other option in San Francisco, but he'd like to stay. He's a young guy. He has friends. They're all artists. And, you know, the story is very typical. And London Breed, actually. So the supervisor, London Breed, told me that she makes $115,000 with her supervisor salary. She lives with a roommate, and she said that if she lost her apartment, she doesn't know what she would do. So she might have to have three or four roommates. And she also brought up the issue that we have different expenses now. So in 2000, during the last tech boom, when the bust happened, we didn't pay for cell phones. We didn't have high-speed internet access to pay for. There's a host of things that we're paying for now. So even as things are getting more expensive, we're also paying more for more things. And there's 100,000 San Franciscans who can't afford high-speed internet access. And if you think that's a luxury, it's not. If you're a student, if you are looking for a job, if you're trying to find an apartment, that's not a luxury.
With all the talk about apps and the sort of immediate culture that we live in, we forget that people don't have internet access even right in San Francisco.
Yeah, 100,000. Yeah, that's what we found. And that's just what we found. That's one of the reporters who worked on that piece at the press. That's what he found. But there may be more. That was an estimate from one of the nonprofits that he worked with.
According to the Council for Community and Economic Research, the overall cost of food in San Francisco is 23% higher than the national average. And then Muni is $2.50 per ride. It's about, what, I think it's 2.5 hours or something that the ticket lasts. And so that's also high for people who have to take public trans, and then BART can be $10 if you're going to the East Bay.
It's very expensive. So I commute back and forth between Oakland and San Francisco all the time, and I can tell you it is very expensive because it's not just one thing. It's getting from BART to the bus and then back again. So you can spend up to $15 a day on a commute. If you go to school or if you work somewhere and you're getting back and forth and you have errands to do, it's quite expensive, and you pay in time.
Well, thank you for calling in about SROs. I think this one's really, really important. According to the piece I just talked about in the Weekly, 63% of families who live in SROs say that they've got respiratory problems because the conditions are making them sick and they're so bad. Today we're joined by Angela Woodall. She's a journalist. She was part of a reporting team who worked with the San Francisco Public Press to look at the high cost of living in San Francisco. This package of stories hits newsstands tomorrow, and then you can find it online on Wednesday. Carl Kramer is co-campaign director of San Francisco's Living Wage Coalition. Today we're talking about how poor, low-income communities, people on fixed incomes, are managing to survive in the Bay Area as income inequality now exceeds national levels. And we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes, I understand there's something called the developer's density bonus has been proposed, and as proposed, you could actually be tearing down rent control units and rebuilding them and then forcing people to show their income every year. And this is true in the Sunset and also in other areas. And also, I think it's important to keep in mind the fact that commercial rents have been going up to the point where small businesses such as hairdressers and food markets are having a hard time staying open. Anybody who has, there's no rent control or vacancy control whatsoever. It's illegal under state law for commercial businesses, and a lot of these commercial businesses are not able to survive because the landlords just want to jack up the rent so much.
Well, yeah, thank you, Harry. What about the developer bonus?
Well, I'm familiar with the density bonus, but I'm not, I don't know the details of that. But what did remind me of what you were talking about, Harry, was it?
Okay.
Was when you mentioned about some of the people who are losing ground, who are losing the spaces they live in. Actually, one of the supervisors is working, I think actually might be two of the supervisors working together on an issue related to that, which are childcare providers. So there's a fair number of childcare providers who run their businesses out of their homes. So if they lose their home, which they are getting evicted or through Section 8, they may have Section 8 housing vouchers, they're having a very hard time finding an affordable place to live. So they're not only losing their business, people who are receiving child care services from them are losing their child care support. They're losing everything. And on top of that, the state subsidies that people that's pegged for the cost of childcare hasn't been reassessed since 2005. So actually, you can be making too much money, but still not making enough to be in San Francisco and to afford your housing and to afford childcare. So that's going to be a really big issue when you have no childcare and you can't afford childcare somewhere else, or you're commuting. I mean, it's a really big tangle. And that reminded me when you mentioned that that's something to look out for in the next few months.
Well, thank you for calling, Harry. We have an email from Emily who says, I'm part of the working poor as a freelance musician and music teacher, although I usually come out ahead in comparison to a minimum wage worker, $3,000-ish a month. I wanted to point out that freelance workers have no safety through work with programs like workers' comp, disability, not to mention health benefits or vacation. Although I fully support the efforts to increase the minimum wage, I wonder if more companies are simply going to switch their workers to 1099 independent contractors. Companies like Uber, Postmates, TaskRabbit do this. Workers have no guarantee of making a minimum wage or a set wage. How can we widen the conversation to include them? Yeah, we've done many, many shows about this and about what's in store for the future of independent workers. Angela, did you all look at this in the San Francisco Public Press package?
Well, yeah, we did look at this because it's really an important issue. So some of the people I talk to are fit into this category. I'm a freelancer. I fit into that category. And the cost of living is so skewed in San Francisco that the Department of Public Health actually has expanded the subsidies for health care. And that's going to be something that will help freelancers to some extent, but not necessarily. So it's a really difficult position to be in. But San Francisco Public Health said, you know, it's so people here who have affordable covered California, they may be able to afford the premiums that are the very lowest premiums, but they can't afford the out-of-pocket expenses. So what people were doing is actually going, because of that, people were either not accessing health care or they were going to the free clinics to get health care and using them because it was more affordable. So those are some of the tactics that people who are kind of, you know, making money but falling through the cracks, especially the 1099ers, they're resorting to these kind of things where you wouldn't have seen that, you know. And there's nothing wrong with benefits, but does it need to be that way?
Carl, is your organization organizing with independent contractors? Just last month, bus drivers for major companies like Yahoo, Genentech, and eBay, the drivers joined the Teamsters. And so their pay is going to rise from $18 an hour to $25 an hour, plus a bonus for working two shifts. They're going to get overtime pay, arbitration procedures, and improved health benefits. Are you organizing with them?
We're certainly supporting those efforts. It's this is actually labor federations around the world are grappling with this issue. Internationally, it's called precarious workers. It could be, you know, street vendors in Latin America. In the United States, the new term that's been coined for this is the gig economy. Where somebody is not even recognized as a worker. They are just picking up jobs through an app. The Seattle City Council is now grappling with this issue because of the Uber drivers who've come to they are campaigning for legislation that would protect their right to organize and to collectively change their wages or their the payment scheme that Uber is imposing on them. This is we're very supportive of campaigns of workers in different industries who are confronting the 1099 status that they are somehow independent contractors, and that abuse is very widespread. Where the employer comes with a piece of paper and demands that the employee sign it, saying that I'm an independent contractor. I'm responsible for all of payments on my Social Security, I have no labor rights on this job. It's part of the campaign that we have in support of janitors and non-union janitors, that that they're being pressured into signing these independent contractor forms, where their working conditions are they're showing up the same shift, having the supervisors shouting orders at them, in no real world do they have any control over their working conditions.
Thank you, Carl. Just 10 seconds, Angela. Did you find our city governments tackling this problem? Is the pressure from the public affecting them at all?
Well, I think that there's a little bit getting through, but there was no planning done for this. We've been through this before, and there was no planning this time.
None.
So I don't really think it's getting through.
Angela Woodall is a journalist. You can find her reporting in San Francisco Public Press. It hits newsstand tomorrow, and on Wednesday it'll be online. Carl Kramer is co-campaign director of San Francisco's Living Wage Coalition. Thank you both for joining us. And thank you for joining us. Thank you for your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the Paris Climate Summit. In a landmark deal, for the first time, 195 countries have agreed to prevent global temperatures from rising above 2 degrees Celsius. The Paris Pact has been hailed as a victory for the planet. Critics argue the deal doesn't go far enough. So what went on behind the scenes, and what should be done to truly deal with the impacts of climate change? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.